committee to order and welcome everybody. And I will go ahead and I will let my partner here open his.
Thank you. Open the Interim Committee on Transportation.
Thank you. I'm going to go ahead and start off by opening a work session on the introduction of committee bills. And Patrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before us, we have you have a list of House and Senate interim transportation bill drafts that are in your packet. Because we don't have a quorum in the House side today, we're only going to deal with the House LC drafts today. There are four of them. We talked about one of them at our previous meeting, and that would be LC 1367, which requires the use of a hands-free device to lawfully use a two-way communication device while operating a vehicle on a highway. That was brought forward by Representative Tomei. I do have one small change that Legislative Council has suggested that we could adopt conceptually on that one. It's on page 2 of LC 1367. Thank you. LC 1367. It's in subsection 4. Currently it says...
What line is that, Patrick?
I'm sorry, line 13.
Thank you.
Actually, line 14. After under 18 years of age, the suggested language is, and who is using a hands-free accessory. The reason why is that language is necessary is currently this draft makes the use of a cell phone without a hands-free device a primary violation. But the way the language in subsection 4 is written is that for a person under 18, it would still be a secondary. Mm-hmm. So to make that consistent, that language is necessary. So Heidi Allmeyer, our drafter, suggested conceptually amending that in there when we make the motion to adopt, if we make the motion to adopt. So that's the first one. The other three, LC.
Could you please repeat the name again?
Oh, thank you. So the language would be on page 2, line 14, after the word age, we would add, and who is using a hands-free accessory. And the remainder of these, LC 1534 extends the move-over requirements that were created by House Bill 2176 in 2003 to include roadside assistance vehicles equipped with warning lights. And then it also contains a definition of those roadside assistance vehicles. This was a bill concept that was suggested by AAA. LC 1536 allows rental and lease companies that rent and lease cars to submit a certificate of non-liability when receiving a notice of a parking violation that was received by that vehicle while it was in possession of a renter or a lessee at the time of the violation. That was brought forward by Catrala. I believe it's the Car and Truck Rental and Lease Association. I think I've got that all right. And then the fourth one is LC 1601, which specifies that road machinery, such as backhoes, front-end loaders, and road graders, and it's an extensive list that's included in the bill, or the draft, are exempt from title and registration requirements provided they are operated in construction zones or on a highway or alley incidental to their use in a highway maintenance operation. This is because DMV is no longer registering or titling these vehicles for road use. But they are still sometimes need to operate on a roadway, so this would exempt those. And that was brought forward by the Association of Oregon Counties, and they worked with DMV, and DMV, I believe, is amenable to that. So those are the four bill drafts we have before us, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We do have people in the audience if there are any questions. Otherwise, I would take a motion to introduce these as committee bills. Madam Chair, I move that we introduce LC 1367 as amended on page 2 of the bill, line 14, after age, who is using a hands-free accessory. Also, LC 1534, 1536, and 1601. It has been moved that we introduce LC 1367 as amended, LC 1534, LC 1536, and LC 1601. Any objections? Seeing none. Ordered.
Okay. Since Senator George, since we have a quorum, we'll go ahead and introduce the two bills that we have ready. Colleagues, we have LC 1363. Senator Monroe provided this, permitting the sale or purchase of catalytic converters without ODOT permit. As I understand from his explanation that he gave us last committee, you know, as an attempt to do something with the metal theft issue. LC 1366, which is at the bottom of your page, is grants authority to the Board of Commissioners of Multnomah County to establish tolls for the use of bridges over Willamette River. This is one Senator Starr talked about, but we thought they had the authority, and they disputed, so we will introduce a bill that will allow them to have that authority if they should so do, and have an interesting discussion about that. And again, members, before I ask for a motion, it's customary that we introduce bills for the committee. It doesn't mean you support them or oppose them. We just want to get them filed for the session. So if there's any questions, I would ask for a motion for those two.
So moved.
Okay, Senator Starr has moved that we introduce LC 1363 and 1366 as committee bills for the 2009 session. Any questions? Any objections? All right, so ordered. The other two colleagues, 1364 and 1365, did receive permission to wait until our November 10th final meeting. There was just so many mistakes. I shouldn't say mistakes. You know, when you ask somebody to draft a concept, it comes out a lot. There was just so much I wanted to change in that before we introduced them. They're making those changes, and we got permission to introduce those on November 10th. So we're going through that right now. With that, I think, Madam Co-Chair, it's all right. We'll go into our information meeting, and we'll open up an informational meeting on women and minority-owned businesses and also the apprenticeship program. And I'll begin by asking Matthew Garrett, Director of Oregon Department of Transportation, to come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Matthew Garrett, Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. Mr. Chairman, I can do this either way. I can speak to the individual issues, speaking first to the women and minority-owned business efforts specific to the Department of Transportation, stand down, let the other good folks share their thoughts, or I can roll both the minority-owned small business effort and the apprentice all at once. I just defer to you.
Well, I think what we'll do, in your case, Mr. Garrett, I think it would be good to go ahead and provide your whole basket. Okay. We may call you back, but at least we'll have that information out. And before you begin, just as a reminder to colleagues, there's been a lot of questions, and you may have been involved with some of those or read some things, and concerned about providing contracts to minority women-owned businesses. You know, that was a specific item that we included in the 2003 OTIA 3 package, and there's a lot of concern, including the chair, about that we're not accomplishing the task that we had asked for. And so I've asked Mr. Garrett and others here to testify is, what is the status? We have barriers. What are they? Are they structural barriers? Are there others? And how do we move to actually getting results? So that's what we're trying to achieve today. So with that, Mr. Garrett, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate it. And also with me is Michael Cobb. Michael's the manager of our Office of Civil Rights. He can certainly answer any questions that I may stumble on. But let me start by saying the intent. Again, the chairman referenced the OTIA 3 bill and a following budget note that said very specifically that involvement of Oregon construction firms and employees, the use of Oregon firms and employees, emerging small business and minority and minorities will result in economic stimulus that will benefit the state overall. We certainly embrace that. We subscribe to it. And we put forth several different efforts on a couple different fronts. I will first speak to trying to put more people of color boots on the ground in our contracts. There is a history. If you look back at our history, there has been somewhat of a challenge. And there have been many barriers that have been articulated to me by folks that we can't get to the table, much less compete for projects. My commitment to what I will term small business, and when I say that, that encompasses this patchwork quilt of minority-owned business, of women-owned business, of emerging small business, of disadvantaged business enterprises. Now, the alphabet soup that has different directions, different constraints within. But I see that as small business, because I know here in the state of Oregon, a small business is the economic backbone of the state. I want to grow those opportunities. I believe that was in, that's truly the intent and what was embedded in the OTA package, economic stimulus, job creation. So the outcome is to grow a more diverse and qualified workforce in order for us to deliver on the infrastructure investments you and your colleagues provide us. We sat down, we listened, we rode circuit, we brought folks from the small business communities to help inform us to better understand what the barriers are in doing business with not only the Department of Transportation, but the state of Oregon in general. And we found some. Some of those were structural within my agency. Some of those were procedural. Some of the issues were outside my agency. They spilled into other sister agencies that we're working with right now to address some of those things. The bottom line is what we've tried to do at ODOT is remove the barriers. We've tried to take away some of the onerous paperwork type issues that we would put these people through. Again, these are small businesses. Not a lot of time to sit down and do the paperwork because they're out boots on the ground getting work or trying to secure work or doing work. I appreciate that. I understood that. Still, we have to make sure that those folks that do come to the table to compete, we have the appropriate information that they do have the capacity, the wherewithal to deliver, to work with the prime contractors, to deliver on the investments. So we looked at various issues. How you compete with the big boys? Can you somehow lower the requirements so we're not having to compete with the major primes? We've done that, and I will articulate on two fronts our ability to drop contract size down so these small firms can enter and be exposed to heavy highway construction, both on the professional and technical side and on the construction side as well. As you lower the contract size, lower the requirements in terms of insurance, in terms of risk, in terms of bondings, these were major barriers to get people to engage in our effort. They just could not play the game at those levels. So again, our first go around was to sit down and listen to these folks. Tell me what the challenges are. Because I promised one thing. I promised them the opportunity to compete. I would remove whatever barriers there were that my agency may have put before them. But I owe them nothing more than that ability to compete. And what I thought I would do is start from a ruling that came from the Ninth Circuit Court, which said, in order for you to have specific goals to target disadvantaged business enterprises in your bid contracts, you must have some compelling evidence to show there is underutilization, inequity, discrimination. And it has to be statistical, it has to be anecdotal. That was a ruling that came back in May of 2005, and what it did is it had a chilling effect for all intents and purposes, that we had to now stand down. And we held on as long as possible. But eventually, under the threat of lawsuit, we stood down. We no longer put those hard goals in. We made a decision to engage in what is termed a disparity study. We wanted to know exactly what the environment, the universe was. Did we have inequity here? Did we have the opportunity to continue business as we were doing, or did we have to make some course corrections here? So we engaged a national firm, a firm that has done business across the nation. We said, go forth and give us a better understanding of what we truly have before us here in the state of Oregon. And what they came back with, they completed their efforts in December of 2007. And what the study showed was while the overall performance of the agency specific to disadvantaged business enterprise was positive, there was some exposure, there was some liability up in the Portland metro area specific to African-American firms and Asian-owned firms. In the subcontracting area, they're saying there's a capacity that exists. You are under that capacity. The term they use is underutilization. In addition, since the time that we had suspended our goals because of that Ninth Circuit ruling, we had seen a decrease of about 30% from about 36 to 38% of the contracts being subcontracts being awarded to disadvantaged business enterprise. It had dropped down during that time frame to about 26. So without the hard rules in there, even though we have good relationships overall, we perform well, as they say, we did see a diminution of this effort. So, now what to do? So we know we have underutilization. It's very specific. It's surgical where the liabilities truly exist. So we said we have a couple options here. We can look at the way we do procurement, or we can seek a waiver from the United States Department of Transportation and its secretary, saying, listen, we have a methodology that has identified this underutilization. We need your concurrence in that methodology, and we will seek a waiver so we can now reinstate hard goals specific to the projects up in the Portland metro area to try to bring equity, a balanced playing field specific to the African American firms and the Asian firms in the areas of subcontracting work. After much collaboration with FHWA here in the state of Oregon, with the folks back in D.C., engagement from Senators Wyden and Congressman Blumenauer, and then with significant engagement by Governor Kulongoski, we navigated the waters. In about 10 months, we secured the waiver. And that's a long time, bureaucratically speaking. That said, my sister state in California had taken 3.5 years to secure the same waiver. It was a significant step forward. It was a solution, not a silver bullet, but a solution to address the underutilization or the inequity identified in the disparity study. So we secured that. We move forward. Now we take the universe, we identify significant projects that will present themselves in the Portland metro region. Coming up, actually, advertised the first week of October was the Highway 217 project. It has an additional lane from TV Highway 226 as you can continue to head down into the Portland metro area. It's roughly a $30 million project. So there's great opportunity there. We look for other projects. We've identified a couple more. But the signature project that we've identified to place hard goals in is 217. So what we've done, there's a methodology that takes the engineer's estimate for the project. It parses out what sub work or type of work that can be done by subcontractors. It looks at the capability, the capacity of African American firms, of Asian owned firms. We've identified about 44 firms that has the capacity to deliver what the work types within this projects are. We do the math and we come up with a specific goal. We have now placed a hard goal for DBEs, African American Asian owned firms, in the 217 contract at 6%. We have an aspirational target for MWESB at 14%. We want to be aggressive on all fronts. While I think these are bold, I think the capacity there. As a matter of fact, our methodology proves that the capacity is there. What I have told everyone, if this agency can bring the opportunities to the table, but it is incumbent upon the subcontracting community, as well as the prime contracting community, to get together and start to build relationships. I think there are relationships that exist amongst these people, but it's not as robust as I think it should be. And since we have a deficit here, what I have done is I've said, here, we have this roster of 44 firms. Make sure you get to know these folks. Yesterday, we had a mandatory pre-bid meeting in the Portland area to talk about the 217 project. Mandatory to the extent that I want to explain what we had done in inserting hard goals, still the aggressive aspirational target of 14% on this specific project. But I also want people to know that this is good business for us now and into the future. As we look to the future here, we know the workforce, the numbers aren't there. How do we continue to grow these opportunities? Here's the first step in this journey to take care of a liability that exists, but also to create new relationships. Because Lord knows we need relationships that will help deliver infrastructure investment in the future. We have a great opportunity in 09. Well, I hope that happens. Because if it happens, that means I can continue in a robust manner to work toward building a more diverse and qualified workforce, especially in these type areas. We had 15 prime contractors in the room yesterday. If you've ever been to the Portland Metro Region 1 offices, there's conference rooms downstairs. It was overflowing. There is interest because I think there is the capacity to deliver on these projects. Now, that's just one tangible example of where we have been to where we are now. And to put it bluntly, everything's rhetoric until you produce outcomes. I can assure you that we will move the numbers. We will secure the bars. I don't think there's any excuses. There'll be no excuses from my agency. There should be no excuses from the prime contractors. There should be no excuses from the subcontractors as well. We've got it in the room. We've shown them the opportunity. I think we'll be able to deliver there. That's one example of what we're trying to do on a specific project. I will tell you, specifically, in trying to grow a more diverse and qualified workforce, we're working on several other fronts. One is emerging small business. These are small contracts. If people want to cut their teeth and get into heavy highway construction, here's a good entryway, a gateway into the world of ODOT and some of its projects. Over the last couple years, we have seen the ESD program experience its greatest growth since its inception. We secured 70 contracts, over $2 million. Small projects, averaging about $35,000 a piece. 70 different contracts exposing folks to the way we do business. Now, this effort, this ESB effort, is kind of race, gender neutral in its approach, but we sit down to make sure that we're being as diverse as possible, opening these things up. And as we look back just a couple years where I have data of the 70 contracts, 15 contracts, over 17%, were awarded to minority-owned businesses, and 20 contracts, a little over 23%, went to women-owned contracts. So again, we're diversifying even that small, specific program. This is where we encourage folks to be certified. We think that's the way we can grow the universe. We think there's great opportunity, and I strongly endorse and continue to counsel small businesses to take advantage of this program. It's a good gateway program. As I mentioned earlier, on two fronts, one of the things we heard is we can't compete with the big boys on many, many levels. So what we have done on the professional and technical side, the engineering and architecture side, we've pulled out projects, projects now that are under $75,000, commensurate reduction in risk and insurance. So we're trying to remove those barriers that prevent folks from engaging. And we've said, here are some opportunities. Engage this effort. And what we have seen to date is we have 11 firms that have come under contract representing just about $1 million. There are four more that are just about to be inked. And this small business program specific to the professional and technical side. So we've seen new faces moving in it. Bottom line, we're moving numbers, exposing more people to do business with the Oregon Department of Transportation. On the same, just flipping the coin now, on the construction side, same type of thing. Drop down the numbers, not to 75, but under $100,000. We launched this in February. We have one contract right now that truly is just being inked as we speak. But there's no question that the success that we've realized on the professional and technical side, we will see this on the construction side. Again, we've leveled the playing ground so these small companies can compete against themselves rather than some of the larger firms. Continuing on another front, Mayor Prozic, and a lot of folks that have a lot of experience doing business. We thought it important to engage these folks with up-and-comers. We have two programs, just a general mentor protege program, where we are working closely with a existing successful program at the Port of Portland. And we've identified existing firms with some maturity, with some up-and-comers, plugging them in there. We'll move forward on that. I think we're going to promote like three different mentor protege opportunities through that program. We've created a mentor protege program with the Associated General Contractors as well. Again, who better? Those are the primes that can teach these folks how to do business on many different levels. Another front we're working on, the small business development centers. Again, one of the basic things, just basic business acumen as a small business. We've engaged the small business development centers across the state to almost do a one-on-one marketing type training to help these folks understand exactly what you need in place to be a successful business. We continue to invest in people through the Turner School or Construction Management School. We've had over 60 small businesses that have been engaged in an intensive 8-week course, which again speaks to some of the basic acumen you need to construct, to do well and prosper in the heavy highway construction field. we tried to make it easier for folks to engage my agency, just saying, let's just say I'm a new person coming into the field and I've got skill sets in landscaping or something right now. At one time when you went to the ODOT website, it was a challenge. You couldn't find your way to those opportunities. We've made it very easy. You just log on. You'll see a site, a link that you just click on. It'll say small contract opportunities. And literally you can go in there and there is a field that you can just type in landscape, hit the button, and it will show you all the projects that has landscape work type ready for it. And as a matter of fact, you can also click another button, and as a small business, you will see which of those prime contractors have shown interest in this project. So you can start that relationship, because that's what it's all about. I continue to work with all groups to make sure that they are working together to establish the relationships. I think that's the first step of successful business. Make sure you have the relationships with the folks that you need to partner with. So as you can see, I, as director, my agency as a whole is committed to this. One final thing I've done to show that I'm trying to bleed this down into the organization, because a Matt Garrett or an ODOT director will come and go. But this way of doing business needs to stay because it is good for the state of Oregon. There are all the aspects that we're being socially responsible, that it's the right thing to do, that there's statutory requirements to do it. But it really cuts to the chase. We will check all those boxes. But it's good business for the state of Oregon to grow this opportunity. That's what needs to be embedded, not only at the Oregon Department of Transportation, but throughout state government. All you need to do is look at the future, see what the workforce challenges are. You know if you make the investments now, there's a dividend that will be yielded. So we will continue to work force on that. I have stood up a new leadership team within my agency, a workforce small business leadership team, a cross-discipline team, looking for ideals, looking for any other barriers that may exist that deny people from coming to the table to compete. So those are the efforts we've undertaken. Up to a year ago, a lot of them were nothing more than rhetoric. They have now turned into tangible examples in terms of people securing contracts and in terms of people of color growing a more diverse workforce on the ground. There are boots on the ground. We have moved the numbers. There is no question about it. From our past, we have learned, but it is not prologue. We are moving forward. And let me end this part of the testimony by saying it is not only us. It will take all the folks engaged in this effort around the table to continue to move this thing forward. It will take my friends, as I mentioned, from the AGC, the prime contractors. They have to be willing to accept this baton that passed the small businesses, whether they're minority-owned, women-owned, emerging small business, just people that want to get into the heavy highway construction field. You got to come to the table. You got to prepare. You got to be ready. And then you have to engage on this front and take advantage of the opportunities. If you don't get in the game, you will secure nothing. We've allowed the opportunities for all these folks to get in the game, prepare folks. It's not a challenge anymore to know where this agency is coming from in terms of wanting to grow this opportunity. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, I'll stand down specific to contracting. Take any questions. If not, I'll roll to
a thank you. I think what we'll do, I'm just going to make a slight variation. So we do have some questions, and rather than maybe get mixed in some of the other things, I think I will ask you to do the apprenticeship in a few minutes. After we have, just so that we keep focus. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Matt, I think maybe I've answered my own question, but you mentioned that some of the small contracts, and I think, contract size of $39,000. So then as I read on further, there were like clearing and grubbing, concrete, flat work, culvert repair, et cetera. So, I mean, that is really a small amount of money. And you're going to be talking later, I would assume, about larger contracts. $39,000 seems like a very small contract.
Well, again, what we're trying to do is grow new faces into the heavy highway construction field. And that's a good gateway type approach, those type of activities. I'll be very honest, it's tough to cut your teeth doing business with the Oregon Department of Transportation. And again, don't take my word for it. There are a lot of prime contractors back there that can tell you. You probably don't want to lead with that. You got to build up the appropriate capacity in terms of the people you can get and the equipment you need to deliver on the requirements. What we have seen specific to disadvantaged business enterprises is folks trying to get into the business that, for whatever reason, just haven't made it and secured contracts. We think this opportunity, by shrinking down, pulling down the contracts, this is what they've told us. Don't make me compete for a $2 million contract with, and I'm just going to make up a firm, a Mohawk Construction or CH2M Hill on the A&E side. Bring something down that's more commensurate with kind of my business environment here, smaller contracts. That will allow them to engage, become familiar with the way of doing business, and potentially grow once they get a couple successes underneath their belt, let's hope. That's the intent of trying to move these folks into these types of work types.
Paul?
Yeah.
So, Matt, I guess when we hear from other people today, am I going to hear that you're just throwing us crumbs, or are we providing a real meal for these folks?
You may hear some, but again, there is the opportunity for people to come to the table and compete for those greater packages. There's no question about it. But again, I'm starting from a concern that was expressed to me that we can't even get to the table. We can't compete. And again, there's a variety of reasons, and maybe some folks will share with you what those reasons are. I'm just trying to remove those barriers to get folks plugged in. Folks can compete at every level, and I think that's key, Representative. Competition. The procurement system we have in the state of Oregon is low bid. It's competitive. That's the way it is. Are there other mechanisms to look at? Sure, and I'm looking at those. Sometimes I am compared to my friends at TriMet. They use a different procurement system. They don't use low bid. They did one time. They're not comfortable with that anymore. What they now use is a cost plus something else. That's a deviation from the way we procure here in the state of Oregon. I need to seek an exception. I need to show there's a public good for me migrating away from low bid to a new way of doing business. But I'm looking at that, again, with a lens coming down specific to workforce diversity. If I use cost as one element, but then I add a workforce history, you give me a history of the way you do business, might that be another way that we can secure greater opportunity for folks? That's something I'm looking at. I will tell you I am on the fourth iteration of that type of procurement system with my federal partners. They're a little uncomfortable. They're not seeing the public benefit as we migrate. And I'll tell you I've had folks saying, I don't want you to migrate. The procurement way of doing business in the state is appropriate. It should be low bid. That means me as a citizen knowing that we're getting the lowest cost approach to the. I get it from both sides, I guess, is the point I'm trying to make here. Mm-hmm. But I want you to know that in the environment that I live in, I think it's incumbent for my agency to secure as many project delivery tools as possible. They're surgical in their approach. They're not a blunt instrument, and I would never use it as a blunt instrument. You have to have the right project to deliver those projects, those specific type investments. So am I looking? You bet. Am I refining? Specifically on this issue, I am. Just haven't got there. But again, I know the way we do business. It's competitive. It's low bid. You'll get some folks saying that's not the best way we should do business.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Matt, thank you for your presentation, and congratulations to ODOT for achieving the waiver on the Highway 217 project. I just like to get some comment from the disparity study recommendations from you. You just mentioned the bidding process. When you're allowed to move away from a low bid, the disparity study seemed to recommend that perhaps the bidder's history in contracting with minority firms might be part of the criteria you could put in. Could you comment on that, please?
Yeah, we're looking at that, and I will tell you, specific for 217, we have asked that question. Now, it kind of falls and has no weight, but it kind of falls in the responsive, non-responsive category. But we've asked that question. Please tell us your history and the way you've engaged disadvantaged business enterprise. Just give me a quick hit on the way you engage that type issue. And again, what I'm trying to do is, I'll be very honest with you, it's probably more symbolic than significant now, but it sends the message that this is important to the way we're going to do business. It informs the discussion. And as I said yesterday before this packed conference room specifically for Highway 217. It's very important for me to better understand the true environment coming from both sides, whether it's the disadvantaged business folk or my prime contractors. That helps me make better business decisions. You can help inform that by answering this question. It's not a spear. I'm not going to poke anybody in the eye. But it's a tool that will be used and may inform another contract delivery type mechanism down the road if indeed I can secure that as well.
Thank you. One follow, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Thank you. Matt, do you have a process in place or is there a plan to respond to the recommendations of the disparity study?
We actually have a document. I thought it was attached to the handout where we literally walk through the recommendations and we say, here are a set of recommendations you've given us and we're engaged in that in the following way, or we've completed it. Here are things that are ongoing and here are some things that were recommended that we just don't see appropriate moving forward. So we tried to answer those on a point-by-point basis.
Thank you.
If we have that
document, I'll be glad to get it over.
Yeah, can we get a copy of that? Because I don't think we have.
I mean, not now,
yeah,
but I mean,
we'll
make sure.
Follow up with
you. Okay.
Appreciate it,
Mr. Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Any other questions from the committee?
Matt, as we move into session, I would appreciate if you could prepare. You know, I'm thinking probably mid-March, you know, for an update on, because I mean, as you had indicated, you were also with 217 and others having other projects that you're kind of getting towards the cusp to see whether, you know, we can reach fruition on some of this. So I know we would like some statistical updates between now and what happened between now and March in terms of your success on some of those or any other barriers that you may have run into. Mr. Cobb, do you have anything you would like to tell us?
Well, I think Director Garrett summed it up pretty well. I just would like to reemphasize the point, though, that ODOT early on recognized that the disparity study was not the answer, is not the answer for the small businesses of Oregon. We need to move to a point where we are building connections between the primes and the subs and pursuing training opportunities and everything that we can do to grow these small businesses. The hard goals program is going to go away in 2010. This is the nature of waivers and DBE programs. The whole thing is that the federal government really wants to, if possible, shy away from segregating, if you will, any one or two ethnic groups and saying you have to put hard goals. They'd rather have it all across the board. So the goals program currently in place is going to be only for 3 years. So it behooves every small business here in Oregon to maintain certification. We saw a significant decrease in certification when we had to cease the original hard goals program to keep certifying a bid. The only way that the primes are going to find them is by making sure the certifications are kept up and that they're bidding on our projects. In the meantime, we can continue providing supportive services programs like the Mentor Protege, the small contracting program. Representative Tomac, the reason that we stopped at that level was to give these small businesses an opportunity to know firsthand what it's like to work with ODOT. We heard through that small business initiative many times. You know, it's a formidable task to even fill out ODOT documents to get pre-qualified, so we reduced the documentation to literally 8 pages to make it simple for them. So we see this as a win-win for all involved. Our focus is on supportive services, helping them to grow. In the meantime, looking at alternative ways of contracting to get that diversity requirement into the contracts, because that's the real winner. That's the real winner there.
Mr. Cobb, just a technical thing. Would you please just identify yourself for the record for those who are listening?
Sorry. Yes, Michael Cobb, Manager, Office of Civil Rights, Oregon Department of Transportation.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
Questions, Mr. Cobb? Okay, we'll have you back, Matt, but I think we may have some questions. But let's have Maurice Romney, Annette Talbot, and John Rakowitz. Please come forward. And I'll let you guys draw straws to see who would like to start.
It looks like I'm drawing the short straw. Chair Metzger and Byer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Rakowitz. I'm the Government Affairs Manager with AGC, Oregon Columbia Chapter. And I have testimony there that's being distributed. Rather than go through it all, I'll hit a few key points and then allow the other panelists to do the same and then take any questions. Key to this is that our leadership is very pleased to be engaged in this conversation. We have taken this issue of minority and women-owned, and I'll take that piece first because it sounds like you want to deal with the intern, the apprenticeship issue later. Very seriously for a long time. You've heard a lot of reference today to the Mentor Protege Program. AGC's involvement in that dates back to the mid-1990s when we, in concert with the Port of Portland, helped jumpstart that in the state of Oregon. My latest numbers I checked before coming here is that there's been 74 graduates of that program as it relates to the construction industry, and if I have my numbers right, 67 of those companies continue to exist today. And that's a key message. I think almost any industry would be pleased with that sort of percentage of survival in just about any industry you want to think about. We support that program in two ways, key ways. One, our general contractors, and you've heard underscored today by the director of ODOT that the engagement of general contractors is key. In our case, both general contractors and large specialty contractors are the volunteer mentors. They sign on for a two-year period, and they sit down with interested new emerging, in particular women minority-owned businesses, and sit down and look page by page at their business plan, how they're building it, and what it's going to take to implement it. So we feel like that is sort of a bedrock of the whole system out there that has that needs to be in place to grow, which is sort of a theme we've heard, I think, so far. The other way we do it is, since that time, we have made annual contributions and will continue into the future making annual contributions to support that program. It's operated by the Port of Portland, but as you've heard today, there are a lot of different players all participating, depending on that. So that'd be one key point. The other note, well, I'll make two notes. On the issue of engagement of AGC and the primes, as Matt has referred to, I would just point out that O'Neill Electric, represented here by Maurice, the president, we met with him last week. We organized a meeting with four of our big primes who do heavy highway construction and began the discussion of how it is his company can participate in that particular market and what it takes, what are the challenges and what are the opportunities, particularly at this moment in time in our economy. So we are doing those kind of things on a regular basis. It's not a program. It's just something you do because it's good for our industry. And the reason we as an industry, it's good public policy, but for our industry, strictly from an industry perspective, I think it's really important to note, AGC in Oregon has plenty of large general and specialty contractors as members, both open and union shops. We also, if you look at the actual numbers, though, the average AGC member is a contractor with 10 employees or less. We're in the business of small business like every other industry in Oregon, and that's easy because we're a small business state. So this is obviously good public policy. We understand that for our business purposes and our industry strength and survival, it's absolutely a necessity for us. So we're engaged in a variety of other ways, more on the workforce side, and I'm going to stop there, take any questions, and hope that we can get to some of the workforce initiatives that we have both launched, that we fund, and that we're aggressively involved in, because it's critical to our to the growth of our industry and, frankly, the survival of our industry into the future.
Nick, we'll go ahead with the other two witnesses, sure. And we'll see what questions we have.
I'm Maurice Romig with O'Neill Electric. Just a little background on my company. It's about 10 years old. We do a lot of work with that. Government agencies, USDA, Forestry Department, GSA, VA hospitals. We're also a veteran-owned company, Army Corps of Engineers. So we're familiar with Portland Air National Guard, PDX, I can go on. But we're familiar with the paperwork that's needed to happen for the ODOT projects. We're also graduates of the Mentor Protégé program, which I think is a great program, with the exception that there's, you can show someone how to do their books, but if there's no work available for them, it becomes a challenge for them to actually stay in business, because if you don't have the work, you're not going to stay in business. So with that, I think another thing that, as far as being able to do work with ODOT, we do about, this year we'll do a little less than $12 million in sales. So we're not, we have about 53 journeyman apprentices out in the field. So we're not a micro company. I think that these newer opportunities are coming, popping up with ODOT. We're enthusiastic about it, but still optimistic as far as whether or not it's going to really pan out. We've kind of gotten our hopes up high in the past and had not necessarily resolved to a positive return for us. I'm not a public speaker, so I'm a little bit nervous.
You're fine.
To bear with me on that. I think that a lot of challenges that we face isn't so much our insurance, isn't so much the learning how to do the business. It's the opportunities that the general contractors provide for us to be able to get the business. I think one of the things that you'll notice a lot of times with, especially with African-American-owned firms and minority-owned firms, they all conglomerate around certain general contractors. And you'll see that a lot where one contractor will say, "We're not there." The other contractors can have a meeting and, we'll all show up. And so I think, that's a difference in philosophy as far as the head, as a president, as far as the management up top. I think that those companies that really are willing to involve themselves with the African-American community will find that, we're more than willing to bid. We're more than willing to sit down and go over our numbers and communicate, our interest with them and be able to give them a good product at the end of the day. Most of my business is repeat business, so, and that's what kept us. We're still growing now. We've always grown. And so even with these trying times, we still have companies call us up and say, "Hey, we want you to take a look at this project."
Glad to hear that. The way the economy is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Annette Talbot. I'm here representing the Oregon Tradeswomen. I'm the vice chair of their nonprofit board. And also, I've had the benefit of doing some research commissioned by Representative Shields on minority contracting. He wasn't able to be here today, so I have some comments that he wanted to share with you based on the research that we've been doing. We're pleased to be here. We've had the opportunity to meet with AGC, Representative Shields and I, and several of the larger contractors, and I think we can share with you today a couple ideas that we found that were in common in terms of increasing the percentage of minority contractors. And I'm Representative Shields wanted to please be aware that he's really happy that ODOT has sought the waiver and received the waiver in record time, and is glad to hear that the goal is at 6%. The aspirational goals are great to hear. I think one of the things we found is that the aspirational goals are aspirational, and unfortunately there's really no good reporting on whether they're ever met. So I think to set the aspirational goals without any transparency and accountability on whether they're reaching them is something we would really like to see improvement on. This is that equal opportunity in Representative Shields' mind, and as the chair's introductory comments indicated, one of the things that OTIA 3 was to advance was diversity in both contracting and the workforce. And I have distributed to you a summary of the key disparity study recommendations, and I would really be glad to see what ODOT has put forward on responding to those, because I think they're great recommendations. They're very race neutral, so they don't require a waiver to implement them. And I think they're really important for the legislature to evaluate which ones have they undertaken, which ones do they plan to, and which ones are they going to come to the legislature in 09 to talk to you about if they require legislative changes. one of the reasons the Oregon Tradeswomen is involved in minority contracting and very supportive of their efforts is that, at least anecdotally, there seems to be a substantial correlation between minority firms hiring a more diverse workforce. And you can see that even in the ODOT apprenticeship reports, that the minority firms owned have more minority workers performing more hours of apprenticeship. And often minority contractors, and I don't know if Maurice could comment on this, are the ones that come up through the trades. They don't come in as an engineer and an owner of a contracting firm. They've actually come up and worked their way up to owning a small firm. And I think that that's important because the key to the trades, as Representative, former Representative Brack can tell you, is that the trades, the only way to get in the trades, the only way to get to be a journey-level worker is through an apprenticeship program. And the tradeswomen support apprenticeship program. So the only way to diversify the contracting business is to diversify the number of apprentices that are moving up through it. So there's a whole pipeline there that I think is really important for the legislature to recognize because it's not necessarily apparent on its face. And the efforts on minority contracting have been mixed. I'm glad to hear Director Garrett talk about his efforts looking at the disparity study recommendations. Representative Shields found it somewhat discouraging that a $50 million ODOT job in his district had an 8% disadvantaged business enterprise goal and only achieved 1% on the contracting goals. He has since been able to meet with AGC and some of those contractors to find other ways to diversify their contracting. Even though the contracts have been let, they can do change orders and some other work. So we're glad to see that the contractors are willing to look at why it didn't work well in that instance, and the T-17 project will be a great opportunity to see it work. I think the additional issue is making sure that there is that transparency and reporting that the chair has asked for in terms of the data. The data on minority contracting, as someone who was commissioned by him to try to find it, was not so easy to find. You can find some percentage of dollars that are available, but you don't see a growth in the number of firms that are being utilized. In fact, the disparity study found that Hispanic, Asian, Native Americans, and non-minority women, all of them were substantially underutilized in prime contracts, all four of those groups. And I don't know what steps are being taken to help that, whether those 15 prime contractors who met with him on a mandatory bid were any of them women or minority firms, because that's where we're seeing a huge issue of not being able to get people from the smaller work to being a prime, and the disparity study speaks to that. So we were hopeful that that can be a more important reporting component. ODOT every month puts out an OT03 report, and it talks about traffic congestion and safety, and we're hoping that apprenticeship and minority contracting can be one of the things that they actually do compliance reviews on and do performance reports, and so it's apparent whether they're meeting their goals. And it's not necessarily that easy at this point in time to find that out. One of the things that the contractors agreed with is in meeting with Representative Shields was that they don't have a good sense of what the contractors in the minority community can bring to the table. So they see a list, they see their name on the list, but they don't know their history. TriMet did a really innovative thing to respond to that, which was to put together a directory. And in the directory, it highlights that each firm's area of work, their past experience, their insurance and bonding, their safety record, their business philosophy. It's actually like a directory that you could use to pick up that really could give you a keen sense of what the contractor's ability is. And the AGC contractors felt that that was great. They're running a business. They have a habit of using certain contractors. We're asking them to do business differently, so ODOT could develop that tool so they could do different business practices, because they wouldn't just go to the contractors they'd previously used. They could experiment with others. And I think that transparency is really important. We really hope that they will continue on that effort and that they will give you a report on the disparity recommendations. Representative Shields asked AGC to meet with Maurice, and we appreciate that they've done that. And we have asked AGC to also comment on the disparity study recommendations and where they would come down on them. So they're, I understand, planning to do that later this fall. So I appreciate your taking the time to hear about this issue today and keep the connection between minority contracting and apprenticeship in the back of your brain, because that is really important. And I would suggest that if they have not always studied TriMet, that it sounds like they have looked to TriMet. TriMet does have contracting design build work that they do, and ODOT has design build authority. They do have design build opportunities that they're doing with OT at 3. And design build does provide some of the flexibility to really encourage more minority contracting. Interstate Max is a great example of where TriMet was extremely successful. So if ODOT can use design build or even CMGC construction management work as a method of increasing minority contracting, that would be great, because that is how contracts in TriMet were really successful in Interstate Max. Thank you.
Thank you. You know, one thing too, Annette, I think that would be helpful, and you both, all three of you, have talked about some examples of that. Is you know, beyond what you know we can do as a legislature or even a department can do, which is significant, but is the basic importance of committed marketing. I mean, if I'm a minority women-owned business, is to get myself in front of those general contractors to show them what I can do through the persuasive efforts of folks like the Association of General Contractors to encourage those large contractors and to host times and get them there and say, we want you to hear about O'Neill Electric. And because I understand that part about you have names, but you know, it's kind of like the old chamber meet and greet on, you know, on Thursdays. I mean, some part of it, I think, in the contracting world themselves, the big guys and little guys, not just the mentoring, but also proactively putting things together. I want to show you what this small company does. So they can touch and feel and be encouraged to reach outside of their own contract list and get introduced to some folks. So I mean, I think it's a partnership that's not just the state, which is important, but also the contractor yourself saying, like you said, Mr. Ackowitz, it's good for business. And, you know, let's take some of the people we do a lot of work with and say part of their effort would be to you know, work on things which we can expose them to other people who can do real good work for them.
Could I respond to that?
Yes, please.
We actually have a number of issues on a number of things underway on that issue. We have a an opportunity council chaired by Noni Causey, who's the president of Rose City Recycling and Disposal. She is a very active individual and is reactivating and expanding our effort to do exactly what you talked about. The council has authority within our organization to go out and do the kind of connections, the kind of recruiting that it takes to do what you're talking about. One of the things we have done in the last year, sort of in the same time frame that all this has been going on with the waiver, is we have eliminated dues. It's free of charge for participants in the Mentor Protege program or in the port of the City of Portland's Sheltered Market program, where they can participate and belong to AGC at no charge to them. And within that, of course, we're supporting businesses of all sizes and shapes with all the kind of technical assistance and business assistance that they can receive as a part of just joining our organization. We believe we'll be doing many more outreach efforts like the one that we just described with Maurice. It was a very good session. We had four large contractors there, and I think it's really, it is incumbent on AGC. Frankly, it's in our interest for a variety of different reasons to do this. So we are active on that already, and we will continue to activate more.
Thank you. What questions from the committee with any of our guests? Senator Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Rackley, you said in your material that you handed out that you support Brad Avakian's plan to restore the vocation, regardless of the details of the plan, but I believe that in that plan doesn't it move that to the Department of Economic Development out of the community colleges? Am I clear on that?
Chair Metzger, Chair Beyer, Senator Berger, I don't know that that has been completely settled. There's a whole reorganization side to Bully Commissioner Avakian's plan. Our focus has been on the reintroduction and availability at the middle school and the high school of what we used to call voc ed, we call technical, because it's so critical. That is, in fact, that is the stream that then can go, you know, it's the recruiting the part of the pipeline that they can then go directly from graduation into apprenticeship programs. So the reason we're supporting, I don't know how evolved, developed, and firm the actual organizational part of it is. We really focus more on what will help us get to the, in fact, we've launched our own website. We have to, as an industry, rebrand our industry, reach out, and offer these kind of classes, we believe, at a middle and high school level to prepare all kinds of kids that they really just don't know about our industry or the opportunities or the apprenticeship opportunities. And so if we can get them that kind of instruction at the middle and high school, we believe that will feed exactly into what Annette was talking about, is you have more apprenticeships. I believe Maurice came up through the trades. Then ultimately what you're doing is growing it from all the different
I appreciate that clarification. Mr. Remick, in the training part of it, did you feel, I know that you've brought an issue about the contracting and fair access, but in the training, do you believe that in the African American community particularly, is that you are getting fair access to workforce development, training for people that really want it? You said now that they've made some financial pathways for you, but just be honest with me and tell me how you feel about that aspect of it as well.
As far as my minorities getting into it, and you know, there's only certain ones I could speak of. I think it's very challenging. If I was an apprentice right now trying to get into the program, I highly doubt I'd be able to get into it.
Thank you. One last follow-up, Mr. Chair. Kind of the bottom line here is that we get statistics of what's not happening, the percentages of the in all three of these organizations. But that doesn't really help me in looking at the study recommendations as to what the problem is. Mm-hmm. In other words, the fact that they're not being able to get the work doesn't tell me why. Mm-hmm. And I think that from the state standpoint, there is so much that they can do. What I feel I would have to do as an elected person is to be sure that we're being fair for everybody and that there's not an advantage to anybody or a disadvantage to some. And outside of that, then it's up to other ways to get there. So I guess that my only comment on your report would be that I can't just say, well, they didn't get it, so that's too bad, and somebody did the wrong thing or made a mistake or were prejudiced. That's maybe not the case at all. Would you like to comment on that?
If I may, Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, I think those are very good points. And one of the things that I think TriMet did really well in trying to engage the minority contracting and the interstate MACs was that they sat down with contractors, minority contractors as well as small contractors, and said, what are the impediments that we can fix? You need to still be entrepreneurial and come and submit the bid and get certified and do all of that legwork. But I think Maurice had said to Representative Shields, yes, but if you continue to submit bids, which take a lot of time, over and over and over again, and you get no result, your likelihood is you're going to stop. And so the real insistence of the owner of companies who are the primes here and the agency themselves is to really make those good faith efforts so that all of the efforts of minority contractors are rewarded at some point. And the disparity study speaks to that. It says that the percentage of bids submitted and the dispense, the in response, the who was awarded is significantly different, and they look at that in a way that statistically shows there's a problem there. So it's not just based on yes, they didn't get it. They looked at the availability, the bid submitted, and the results, and they found a substantial disparity. So yes, you're absolutely right. They have to take that initiative. But when you looked at TriNet, they did. They created small bid packages all on their own. They didn't wait for the contractor to do it. They did it. They said, make them small. That would benefit any small business, not just minority business. So I think TriNet went out of their way to take race-neutral ways to get small business engaged. And that included requiring primes to come and hear presentations from subs and actually let them do a presentation to them. So they weren't just reading something on the page about the firm. They actually got to see them, hear them, talk to them. That would be a great method, I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe you can't do that on every single job, and I understand that because they have way more jobs than just Interstate Max. But that networking and the availability to have that one-on-one exposure, regardless of what race the small contractor is, that's what gets them jobs. And so their initiative is great, and I think Maurice will tell you he's made lots of bids on projects, and the frustration level becomes if you never get the result, you stop going because you feel maybe the system is not responsive to you for whatever reason. Could be race, it could be something different, but just that ability to make sure that there's monitoring. I think it's great to have these aspirational goals, but the research I did for Representative Shields finds that for minority and women emerging small businesses, they're meeting the goals on less than 10% of the projects on when they set goals. That's a goal without any result. So I absolutely agree that it's important to not give a leg up that's different than other contractors, except where they have the hard goals because they have statistical disparity studies saying that that's acceptable. But they do and can take other steps. If you look at Stacey Whitback, in a contractor for Interstate Max, and what they did, they went out of their way to engage the minority community in the Portland Northeast area in order, as an owner, to get that participation. That was a relationship building effort. Yeah. So we can ask owners to do that as well as ODOT. But eventually the contractors have to see some results to feel like their participation is going to be rewarded.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Any other questions? We're going to move on to the apprenticeship for the moment because they're somewhat related in terms of the process. But thank you very much. And your points are well taken. And obviously our goal is to see those results. I know that is Matt's goal as well. To actually get more results and find ways to do this. And to the extent that we all collaborate, business, those subcontractors, the department, is an excellent example on that. Your example is Jason Whitbeck to what they did to kind of reach out for that, to encourage more of our highway contractors to do the same, make them sit in the preview. if we have to force relationship building, that might be helpful in some cases. So, well, thank you very much. I'm going to, you want to stay in at UVA because I see that you want to testify on the apprenticeship part. Why don't we ask Connie Ashford to come up and Bob Shipwreck to kind of do this in reverse order, Matt, so you could respond to, because I think this is why we're here. So, and talk about the apprenticeship side. We've had a number of meetings ourselves off committee about this, and we'll let them talk about our apprenticeship needs. Welcome, whoever would like to begin.
Okay, thank you, Chair Metzger. I'm Connie Ashbrook, Executive Director of Oregon Tradesmen Incorporated, and I really appreciate the opportunity to address the Transportation Committee. I have the fortunate experience of myself having worked 17 years in the construction trades, 2 years of those in heavy highway. In fact, if any of you have ever been to the Portland airport, you've driven and driven on I-205, you've driven on a bridge system that I helped build as a carpenter apprentice, and I still get a thrill of pride when I go over that interchange system, and that's one of the benefits of working in the trades, which is one of the things we talk to the young women that come into our pre-apprenticeship program and the girls that we come into our construction camps and other construction training programs. So my testimony today is in appreciation and support for ODOT's Workforce Diversity Plan and in request of your support for ODOT's continued implementation efforts towards achieving a qualified and diverse construction workforce and minority contractor pool in order to build the highways and bridges of the future in Oregon. As you may know, Oregon Tradeswoman currently has a one-year, $150,000 contract with ODOT to provide the following services: career information, career counseling, and help finding employment in the highway trades for women and minority men, particularly African Americans, and to assist highway contractors with finding qualified workers and educating youth about highway trades careers. To date, we have educated 6,190 youth about highway careers through 22 different activities, provided career counseling to 228 individuals, referred 39 candidates to highway apprenticeships, and had 11 candidates start highway jobs, and received one highway contractor request for a worker. I want to thank the folks from Wildish Construction that are here. They hired one of our candidates, and they also provided a field trip to our class of pre-apprenticeship students so they could learn firsthand what it was like working on a highway construction career. I want to take a brief moment to walk through the packet with you and show you just some outreach cards that help our community learn about what we're doing, our accomplishments from 2007, a story about one of our graduates, some more information about our pre-apprenticeship program, information about the 52 women that we helped find jobs in the trades from 2007 to 2008 of this year. A little bit of information about the historical record of how many people came into the main trades, both highway and building trades, over the last 10 years. An article about our pre-apprenticeship program, the women that actually helped build the community as they were in class learning to do more building. An executive summary from a report from the Office of Port Jobs in Seattle with their apprenticeship success, a report from our Women in Trades Career Fair of 2008, and finally, information about the 33 different apprenticeship programs in the Portland area, both union and open shop, that we developed to help our audience understand the very, very complex world of apprenticeship, because it is very hard and competitive to get into apprenticeship, and you need a lot of guidance, hand-holding, many times some career ladder jobs, the entry-level job, in order to compete in the very, very competitive opportunities, since it is the highest-paid blue-collar careers that there are. The apprenticeship system is very important to our state in order to have the trained workers we need to build highways efficiently, cheaply, professionally, safely, and right the first time. Apprenticeship training means that Oregon workers have the credentials they need to have family wage careers, and highway construction workers build on their credentials and work experience to go on to become municipal maintenance workers, supervisors, and even business owners. With 16.6% of women and 27.8% of single mothers living below the poverty level, the trades provide a viable alternative to low-wage work, helping families move out of poverty. We have observed ODOT to be committed to a comprehensive strategy that is making a difference. They have a good plan, we can see results, and I want to express kudos to ODOT staff and for the pleasure that we've had working with them and for their leadership in this area. However, we see that it would be great benefit for the women and minority men that we're working with to see greater transparency and accountability in setting, measuring, and publicizing performance measures around apprenticeship, training, and workforce diversity on ODOT projects. We need legislative support and clear direction to ODOT and ODOT contractors that performance measures will be taken extremely seriously. And I have three specific recommendations that we move to a 10% apprenticeship utilization goal by craft. It's very important to have it by craft. And over time, gradually move to the 20% that is being achieved in the Portland area by the City of Portland, TriMet, and the Portland Development Commission and others. We would like to see a highly detailed plan for workforce diversity to be submitted as part of the contractor's bid package and made public as part of the post-award activities. This will really facilitate us working with the contractors, especially to identify which of the contractors are very interested in hiring our graduates, the men we're providing career counseling to, working with us to educate young women, and hosting the field trips that is so important to understand what construction is all about. And also to use past contractor history in achieving minority contracting and workforce diversity as a measure of a responsible bidder. This is a very important part of the disparity study that we hope gets adopted. So thank you very much for your time and attention. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Since you're with the same group, we'll just go to Mr. Shipwreck, I think.
Is this one working? Maybe I should use this. Thank you. I'm Bob Shipwreck, Executive Secretary of the Oregon Building and Construction Trades Council. I was invited here today to talk about the apprenticeship program within ODOT. I don't have a lot of comments to make because I kind of expected to try and answer a lot of questions perhaps that you have, but just a few opening comments and then I'll be happy to take some questions. First of all, I'm glad that the committee has split the issues between contracting and training. These issues consistently get mixed and they are not. In fact, I was asked to come on the contractor side of the agenda today and I refuse. I don't represent contractors. I represent workers, and I'm happy to talk about apprenticeship, but I'm in no position or paid to talk about contracting, and that's for other people, although they sometimes unfortunately get combined. Part of the problem, I think we might as well just get to, you wouldn't have invited us here if there wasn't some concerns about the ODOT apprenticeship program. It was created, as Mr. Garrett said, through a budget note in Ways and Means three sessions ago. That's a problem in that when the legislature wants to develop public policy in a non-public fashion by sticking something in a budget note, it doesn't give the industry a lot of chance to talk about this and vet these issues in front of a committee such as yours. So ODOT had a budget note, was then expected to hit these goals with very little direction. This is not what they're set up to do. They are not trainers, unless they're training their own employees. And so it's been rather rocky. And for that, I don't blame ODOT. They had a task to do with, again, very little direction as to how they were going to achieve it. And in an area that's not what they do. So it led to a program, first of all, to set up a registry. They were going to go find workers for us. Well, we told the unionized sector of the industry, at least, and ultimately I learned the non-union sector, we don't need the state to go find us workers to do construction work. We've been doing this for about 100 years in this state, and can do a pretty fine job of it. That program eventually just recently went away. as I understand, none of the kids that were on the list ever got a job, and there were for a variety of reasons that I won't go into right now. There was also some talk, and Senator Metzger facilitated a meeting with the AGC and some contractors and us over perhaps setting up a school in Eastern Oregon to recruit workers and train. Unfortunately, it was totally in the non-union sector, and there was some issues about that, and I guess we're not going to do that, and that's a good thing. But the problem we have is that we would prefer the money that is being spent on this stuff being spent on asphalt, rebar, concrete instead of the training that the private sector is more than capable of doing, and in fact would do a better job in the first place. Part of it, I think, is just a lack of understanding about how apprenticeship works. We have committees that move these apprentices around so that they get a wide variety of experience. You don't just work on bridge structures all your career, or you can hardly call yourself a well-rounded journeyman. You know, you're going to work at high-tech plants, paper mills, and other things. So that's important. The other thing that we're concerned is not all the programs are the same. Some of the programs, even in the same craft, will be much better than perhaps another committee that has a program. So you have issues of quality, issues that we're bringing to the attention of Boldy, and you'll probably see some legislation next session to increase the compliance in the apprenticeship program so that it's clear that these young people are learning a career and not just meeting a goal. The other thing that I just briefly hit on that I think created the budget mode, and when OTEA 3 was passed, I had legislators come to me and go, "Bob, what are you going to do? You'll never man all that work." And I said, "Sure we will. We can do it. Our industry is very, very dynamic. We take ups and downs, and we're heading into a big down right now, but that's another story for another committee, perhaps. But I did a little study of my own with the Oregon Department of Employment, Art Ehrers, the state's labor economist. And they're going to say, "Oh, everybody's getting so old, and they're all going to retire, and all this." So I did a study with Art, and construction's the third youngest workforce in our state. I don't know if you know this. There's never been so many 18-year-olds in the United States or the state of Oregon than there is today. Any workforce shortages are probably, the economists predict, maybe in about 10 years.
Apologize for the noise, but we have construction work going on, and that's a good thing.
Bless them, you're one of my guys. So we have no problems, and I want to reiterate this, no problems getting young people into your trades. Where else were these people to go to get that kind of an education, make that kind of money, and have fringe benefits, full family medical, pensions, 401ks? I mean, where else are you going to get it? And let's face it, we all know everybody's not going to college. So we don't have a problem. In fact, ODOT did, some contractors said, "Well, we can't hire apprentices because they don't have any." So ODOT on their own, and I did follow up with it, my own folks, did a census of the, basically we call them the five basic crafts that do highway work. They found 500 out-of-work apprentices, or people what we call on the list of eligibles that could be an apprentice tomorrow. We've already interviewed, they passed everything, but we didn't have a job for them. 500. We have plenty of people ready and willing to go to work. So I just get a little concern when people start saying we don't have workers. That is not true. And as an aside, I suspect in a few months I'll be testifying to this legislature that about 40% of our folks will be unemployed due to the downturn in the economy. We're already seeing it. For the benefit of the committee, I did this a few years ago. I commissioned the University of Oregon to do a complete study of the Boldy Apprenticeship Program. It'll be modern. The other numbers are getting a little old. In that first study, it showed that my organization's affiliates were at or above all EEO requirements. So we are getting women and minorities into the trades above what the feds require. I think my new numbers will show an even better percentage. So I will be sharing that with the entire legislature. So you folks have an idea of what's happening in the Oregon apprenticeship system for construction workers. And last but not least, I just want to say this. You know my theory. Most of you know me. You wouldn't have me drive down here just to, you know, snooze. But I just want to say that I personally and my affiliates don't believe there's any excuse why we're not hitting 10% apprentices on these jobs. No excuse whatsoever. The standard ratio is 3 journeymen to 1 apprentice. I understand there's projects in way very foreign parts of the state. We have people that live there too or that will take the jobs, but if you hear in other testimony that we don't have the people or that they can't get 10%, I would ask you to have people explain that rationale, because I don't buy it. That's all my comments.
Okay, thank you. Questions for any three we have here?
Just to clarify, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So, but you didn't say foreign part of the states, did you?
No, I said more foreign.
Not boring.
Actually, most of them are not boring.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
If I might have a minute to comment on the 10% goal, since Connie didn't address that.
Okay, go ahead and identify yourself and do that then.
Annette Talbot, Oregon Tradeswomen. I think the 10% goal per craft, I was involved in negotiating with ODOT on that when a previous job as Deputy Labor Commissioner, and we did a lot of negotiations with ABC and the industry on that 10%, and it was really clear that the per craft goal, as Bob said, is really important. The other piece to that, though, was the diversity piece, which was the women and the minorities aspirational goals of it. And as I mentioned earlier, the only way to diversify the workforce is to assure that those women and minorities are getting in the pipeline. And so I think that it would be helpful for ODOT. My understanding is their new program is to pay for performance to reach that 10% apprenticeship goal, but I don't know where the aspirational goals fit in that, because it's wonderful if they pay for that 10% training, but if it's not a diversified group of workers coming in, then we haven't met the diversification requirement that the ODOT 3 program was intended to meet. So, and I think I always want to call him Representative Shipwreck. Bob Shipwreck.
Judge how long you've been around.
I'm old. That's right. I think that the key is how much money has the agency budgeted for that goal of paying for the 10% that could be going to, as he said, building more projects. And I did a review for Representative Shields. Approximately 50% of the contractors in the last report were actually meeting the 10% per craft goal. Now, is that could use improvement? Sure. But if 50% are meeting it without being paid to do it, it seems to me that you should be looking at how to improve that program as it is with some compliance and perhaps some accountability measures and enforcement as opposed to resorting to paying for performance.
Right.
So,
good point on that.
Thank you. Any questions for these folks before we get Mr. Garrett up to respond and comment about what ODOT is doing on the apprenticeship side? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You may still have some. Mr. Garrett, go ahead, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, Matthew Garrett, Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. You have my testimony, which walks through this side of the issue. And I thought Ms. Ashbrook did a very good job articulating the mechanics in terms of how we try to fill the pipeline in terms of making investments to train folks, to let them understand the certain business acumen and specific skills one needs to become apprentice ready. So, and I thought Mr. Shipwreck did a very good job of articulating one side of the message that I've heard. But I'd be remiss if I didn't share with you. And Mr. Shipwreck says, the cup runneth over.
so to speak. And again, I went today, as a matter of fact, I went out to the joint apprentice training program for the iron workers, because they're most successful. Their cup truly runneth over. The line, the number of folks that stand ready to move into apprenticeship jobs is solid and robust. There are some crafts that dip below, just my conversations with Lori Warner over in employment. We're not all running over. That said, the message that I have got is we either have all the workers we need, but when I talk to my folks from AGC, or some of the folks from AGC, they're saying, Garrett, we can't even make the 10% with what we have. There's some conversation, again, as you look at the direction, as we try to grow this opportunity specific to apprentices. And again, let me first start by saying, I'm just trying to grow the opportunity. The apprentice program is race, gender neutral. That's a federal direction that we come. So I appreciate where Ms. Talbot wants to go. And let me tell you, we are parsing information to make sure we are touching on those things. But the program itself is somewhat disciplined to be race, gender neutral. I'm trying to grow that overall pot. There's no question about it. So the challenge that I face is, while we have seen movement, and I think on page 11 we kind of show the percentage of rise that has us securing in 2008, clearing the 10% bar, but you can see the steady climb. But I would remind folks, this is specific just to OTIA 3 investment and the projects in the Portland metro area. It's not all the projects we do. So now I look at the situation. I have my friends on the building trade side saying, listen, you don't need to pay these folks. And again, it is an incentive, disincentive, to secure the 10%. If they don't make it, I'm taking money away from the contractors. So I'm trying to incent growing opportunity, because when it all is said and done, that's the outcome we want. We want to grow the apprentice opportunities here in the state of Oregon. I think that serves us well into the future. It's a challenge now, and it'll serve us well in the future. But faced with a situation that I have a lot, I don't have a lot, how do I do this? So we course corrected. We actually throttled back on the per craft direction, because we weren't making it across the board. If I'm going to grow this for everything we do, I got to figure out how to do it. I want to clear that bar. That's my outcome. I believe that's the outcome of Mr. Shipwreck and his good folks. I believe that's the outcome of the AGC and those contractors as well. They want to grow the workforce. They want to grow these apprentice opportunities. But how do you do it? Again, with all due respect, the direction from the legislature wasn't real crisp. I read it to you earlier. So we charted a course. It was a pilot. It didn't produce the outcome. That's the reality. I throttled back. We course corrected. We went for this incentive, disincentive approach. I'm trying to clear the bar. It will either work or it won't. But that's the outcome. That's the direction my agency has taken. So we'll continue to work this. We'll work again, much like in growing the opportunities on the construction side. It's going to take all of us sitting around the table, making sure that the directions we go, right, wrong, or indifferent, the cross pressures will send us in a direction that yields the outcome of growing apprentice opportunities in the state of Oregon. Any direction from you and your colleagues would be accepted, embraced. My organization executes.
Oh, you say that now.
Folks, I'm serious. But let us have the robust conversation. I think Mr. Shipwreck is right. Budget notes serve their purpose, but they're not the robust conversation we need. This is a very sensitive issue. There's no question. Trying to learn from all sides, I'm getting a lot of mixed messages on this. I think anything that can help bring direction, that yields the outcomes that I think we all want, the intent that was embedded in OTIA, I'm willing to take that. And I think rather than me going through things, I'm happy to accept questions right now, but I want you to know where I am on this, but the mixed message that I'm receiving from significant partners in the transportation sector.
Thank you, Mr. Garrett. A couple things. In some of the discussions that we had together over at your office with the stakeholders that were involved here, including Mr. Shipwreck and AGC, one of the things we did talk about is kind of on a course correction plan might to look at future contracting on the incentive disincentive, is to making the disincentive a bit more
robust, shall we say, so that it won't be dismissed by some contractors, oh, it's just a cost of doing business, we're not going to do it. Is that still something that you're looking at in terms of making sure they understand this is important to us?
Absolutely. Again, I think on a continuum, you've got the carrots and you've got the sticks. I think our approach initially was, let's see if we can incent, with some disincentive, again, it hits their pocketbook if they don't secure the specific percentage of 10%. And I want to grow the percentages. That was embedded in the conversations surrounding this effort as well. But it's not right to grow it because we're challenged just to meet the 10% now. I will look at that. Again, on the far end of the continuum, where some people would want me to go right now, is to hold these folks in breach, which means I'm shutting down the projects. If there are a lot of performance measures associated with my organization, but I think the one that I'm truly judged by, am I delivering on the investments that you and your colleagues provide? And all is said and done, I should be judged on that. Shutting projects down doesn't get me there. So somewhere between those bookends, I'm going to have to find the compromise. I will look. I think there needs to be pain. A disincentive needs to be a disincentive. I just want people saying I'm going to write that off. I'm communicating that with the contractors. We negotiated the situation we're in right now with regard to disincentive. We will, of course, correct on that. I think that's some advice that those good folks heard when we were sitting around the table.
Thank you, Chair. Okay, questions? You know, gentlemen, from ODOT. Yes, Representative Buckley first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Matt, just because Representative Reed and I were just, amazed by hearing the testimony. What a gap in communications. What efforts have you taken to try to bridge that gap between the contractors and the trades to say, look, you guys are talking two different realities here. But one reality is, there's not enough workers. The other reality is, we have more than enough. What efforts have you made to make that link happen?
Well, Chair Mester, Representative Buckley, shuttle diplomacy, to be very honest with you, and then engaging Chair Metzger to say, hey, listen, I want you to know what I'm hearing. Maybe you can bring these folks together because, again, they are part of the transportation industry, the transportation sector, and I truly believe this, that their success is our success and vice versa. So how can we remove what is a blemish? And it's become a blemish on an investment package that we are delivering. I don't want to come to you and your folks in 2009, tell you how great we're delivering the OT investment of 03 because, hey, I may be asking for a little more in 09. I don't want it blemished with these things. I'm trying to remove it. So right now, these are professionals. We're sitting around the table and we're trying to negotiate. Rather than doing it in silos, I'm bringing them around the table saying, here's where we're going to go. I asked the senator to convene the meeting. I needed some juice, to be very honest with you, because I can make the request. But listen, bring folks in. I want you to know that there's legislative interest in this. This is just not Garrett promoting this initiative or that initiative. But that said, then an ongoing charge that we will stay around the table and we will find a solution to remove this issue as we move to 2009. That's my commitment.
I appreciate it. One quick follow?
Yeah.
Just personal recommendation, Mr. Chair, please feel free to throw furniture if you need to in those meetings. Do you ever...
We don't do that in the Senate. It may be normal in the House, but we don't do that.
It's a tradition in the House, sir. Back in the days when I worked on a number of short-term contracts and would go on unemployment when I was off a contract, I had to verify that I was looking for a job when I was on unemployment. Is there any possibility of putting some sort of sign off where the building trades have to sign up saying, yes, we've been requested to supply X number of apprentices for this project and no, we don't have them? Could that be part of the contracting process?
It's something we can look at. Again, I'll be very honest with you. I'm going to rely on the professionals on the building trade sides and the AGC to help me arrive at a solution. I think we can. I'm not trying to play gotcha on this thing. I'm trying to produce an outcome that benefits, I think, the state of Oregon here. I know they understand the gravity and the sensitivities associated with us. We are at 180. I don't know if we migrated a whole lot closer with one meeting. I can assure you we'll have several other meetings and we will find a solution that addresses the issue.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, my apologies for mentioning furniture.
That's right. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Matt, I was noticing on page 10 of your material that you gave us that apprenticeship participation by hours. And we heard from the previous speaker that there are like 20% of people in the workforce are apprentices. So I'm wondering, is that sort of a problem? Because if a journeyman would be paid this amount of money, an apprentice would be paid this amount of money, and if a contractor is presenting this contract, and there might be some inducement to have fewer apprenticeship hours because they would, their contract would be larger if they used journeymen instead of apprentices.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, Representative Tomei, it's my understanding there are kind of rules of engagement in terms of the number of apprentices on the job versus the number of journeymen. And I think it's 3 to 1 or 4 to 1. I forget what it is. I think Mr. Shipwreck said 3 to 1. I've heard 4 to 1. Those are kind of rules of the game that are established by this greater apprentice universe that's out there that brings discipline and focus to the effort. It's an esoteric world in terms of looking at a project, and we make some estimates as to how many hours of apprentice work we believe will take place. We do that prior to a project being opened up, and obviously things can change when you open up the patient, so to speak. But we do our very best from the outset, and we continue to refine this working with the contracting community on saying, we look at Project X, we look at the attributes within that project, and we identify a certain number of hours that we think apprenticeship work needs to be engaged in. And that's the way we set the hours, and that's the way we're setting the goals on the thing. With regard to the boots on the ground, whether it's a journeyman or an apprentice, that's set by some other apprentice body beyond the Department of Transportation. We just play by those rules of engagement.
I'm not sure I understand it any better.
I apologize if I confuse you. I'm probably not the right one to answer that question. Maybe Mr. Shipwreck or one of the folks that are more versed in this issue can help.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Would you like some additional comments on it?
Sure.
Bob, do you feel you can take a shot at Representative Tomei's question? And then I think we're going to be moving on to our next topic here.
Mr. Chair, could I ask one quick question?
Yeah, let's let him respond there, and then we will finish up with this. Yes.
Bob, do you understand what I was asking?
Could you please restate it?
Sure. Is there some inducement on the part of contractors to have fewer apprentices as compared to journeymen, because they would get a larger contract if they're paying journeymen so much per hour and paying apprentices a small proportion of that?
Bob Shipwreck, Oregon Building Trades Council. It will vary between contractors and the type of work that they're doing. Certain types of work here, the contractors may not want a lot of inexperienced people. It's dangerous. We have, in fact, an agreement with ODOT on certain projects. We waive the apprenticeship rule because the employer says, I am not going to put an inexperienced person at risk. And there's no disputes about that. I don't bid. As I said, I'm not a contractor, but it's clear in a competitive bid market, which is what ODOT traditionally does, you're looking at apprentices that are going to be making anywhere from minimum 40-50% of the journeyman scale. Obviously, they're doing some tasks. It's a little different or harder for other crafts. Crane operators, for instance, is the toughest. How do you get two people in the cab of a crane? It's and these contractors are bidding. I mean, they know where their opposition's numbers are going to be. So they're going to use what will it take for me to get that low bid? Perhaps I want to utilize more apprentices. Maybe I don't. My journeymen are more productive. It's a pure business thing, in my opinion. And that's what I've heard from other contractors. But remember, if you're not a registered apprentice, you have to pay journeyman scale. That's the law. So I've always felt that it was good to hire as many apprentices as you could, because that does lower your bid, and assuming that they're, they are going to do something. And I hope that answers your question. And Mr. Chairman, in the interest of disclosure, I mean, you guys picked up kind of what I was saying, kind of what Matt was saying.
I'll just be frank with you. I was not clear, and I apologize. I represent the union side of the industry. We spend millions, tens of millions of dollars a year on training. We have, at this point, 500 people ready to go to work. There is another side to this industry that is not unionized. They do not have the programs we have. They don't have the people. I'm not here to do union, non-union. I'm not here for that, but you deserve an answer to your question, and that's the problem. We did meet with the open shop side of AGC, and they admitted at that meeting, this was some time ago, we simply can't get people basically out of the Portland area on a job. There are 3 non-union cement masons registered at the state of Oregon, maybe 4. There's about 70 union cement masons. We just took 35 in this summer. I mean, that's what's going on here, and I hope you just respect my candor and honesty here, okay?
Senator Berger, then we'll move on.
Yes, I have just one quick question for the director. There are reasons that an agency gets a budget note. It isn't just like it fell out of the sky and there was no discussion. So obviously there was a level of concern. My level of concern right now is the discussion of the money that is being spent on the apprentice program that could be going into other things. And I think it's a fair question to you to ask you as the director, do you feel that you could give up your apprentice program in order to be more creatively budgeting the funds that you have?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berger, the program is not producing outcomes. I want to produce outcomes. If I can get to a point, and again, Mr. Shiprock stated it well, just remove union, non-union issues. Produce apprentices. If there's a mechanism out there that can do that and deliver on that, we can throttle back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you all, and Mr. Garrett, as we talked about before on the other issue, and when we met in your offices, we'll be looking for an update on that and hopefully provide clearer direction, I think, for our next go-around in transportation in 2009. I realize you are in a tough situation in some of those places. You're trying to deliver projects and not manage management and labor issues, but we want to see the results, and so we want to be able to provide whatever tools that you can effectively use in your contracting for that to be done, and I know we all want the outcome, so we'll keep an eye on that. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good.
I'm going to turn the gavel over to Chairwoman Beyer to conduct our final two reports.
Thank you. I'm going to go ahead and open the update on the signs task force, which was a part of House Bill 2273. Representative Tobias Reed has been the House member of that committee. And he's going to go ahead and do the update. We do have someone from ODOT here if we run into any questions, but I'm sure Tobias is going to do a great job.
Yeah, I'm asking for assistance.
Or Representative Reed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tobias Reed, State Representative from District 27. If one of you had come to me a couple of years ago and said in October of 2008 you'll be sitting before the Transportation Committee talking about billboards, I'm not sure I would have believed you. But here we are with an interesting discussion and an update for you on some work we've been doing. You'll recall, I'm sure, House Bill 2273 from the 2007 session that resulted from a Supreme Court case based on the Federal Highway Beautification Act, that some of you may remember, it's the Lady Bird Johnson Act, that required states to figure out a way to regulate outdoor advertising. We've been doing that for a while, and as a result of that Supreme Court case, we needed to find a new way to do that. The penalty
or what the risk was if we didn't find an adequate way to regulate outdoor advertising was some significant dollars for the state from highway funding. About $30 million was the estimate. So we wanted to get that taken care of, and we believe we've done that. But in the course of that discussion about an adequate and effective way to regulate outdoor advertising, we discovered a number of other issues that we weren't, I think it's fair to say, prepared to deal with the detail that we thought appropriate in the 2007 session, running the risk of that federal highway money. So we created a task force that we've been engaged in since last year, and we've been talking about a lot of different issues in that process. I'm fortunate to have a good group that's been engaged in that process. Senator Metzger has been part of it. Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation has been our able expert, and a number of people who are involved in the industry who are here as well today. So really, I think what the message we're here to deliver is that our process is ongoing. We've talked about a lot of different things, and I think we didn't rehearse very well ahead of time, but I might just mention a couple of the sort of bullet point forms that a couple of the issues in bullet point form that we've talked about. We submitted a written report that may form the basis for legislation that might be considered by the legislature in the next session, and then we can answer questions, and I'm sure there might be others who want to have something to say about it. We've talked about increased penalties for those who are not complying with the law when it comes to outdoor advertising. We have what looks like good consensus on that. We've talked about the use of emerging technology. Other states are allowing digital billboards, and we've talked about whether that might make sense as a pilot program in Oregon. There's a bit of an interesting arrangement that resulted from the initial implementation of our regulatory system that involves use of relocation credits. The original legislation established a cap on the number of outdoor advertising signs and allowed a credit if someone took a sign down through the loss of an arrangement with the property owner or other issues, that they could then replace that sign somewhere else. So we've been talking about how that works, the possibility of allowing aggregation of those signs if smaller ones could be combined into a larger sign. We've talked about the segmentation of scenic byways. Of course, one of the motivations for regulating outdoor signs is how that interacts with the natural environment and where it might make sense to designate different segments of scenic byways differently. We talked about interaction with vegetation, how that the new system that ODOT has created and whether that's working, and some of the funding that deals with the office that Amy directs, and how that might interact with the outdoor regulation sign. So I think that's a rough estimate, and I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Reed, in committee, we did hear testimony from property owners who expressed some frustration about different companies basically giving them a take it or leave it type of offer. Is there any discussion about a floor for payment to property owner for use of their property for billboard purposes?
Okay, I'm sure, Representative Buckley, we have not talked about that specifically. As I recall, in an early meeting, I think we did have a property owner come and testify at a committee meeting, but it has not been an ongoing topic of discussion for us to this point.
May I follow this one? Is there any opportunity for property owners to have input into the work group's discussion?
I'm sure, Representative Buckley, yes. Our meetings have been public. Our last one is scheduled on the 14th, but I think I'm comfortable in saying that we would welcome anyone's testimony or written comments if they want to reach out to us.
Great, thank you.
Any other questions? Well, and I guess I just have a question. These are all subjects of discussion, and you anticipate a written report before session?
Madam Chair, we do. I think, and Senator Metzger can correct me, I think our intent is on several of the issues that I mentioned, there's emerging consensus, and I think we will note that. On some others, there's still a variety of perspectives, and I think we'll note that as well. And I think there are those who are interested. I may be one of them in submitting some legislation to deal with some or all of those content. But I don't think it's reasonable for us to promise that we will have consensus on every aspect of the things that we've discussed.
Thank you. So, and with that, when I don't see any other questions, the question is whether or not did you want, and we don't have anyone else on the agenda to speak, so we want to allow anyone else to speak.
Madam Chair, I would defer to your expertise on that topic. I wouldn't have any objection to anyone who's been involved or any member of the public who wants to offer any testimony.
That's a good question. We're at 3:00 now, and we still have a couple more items to get to. Is there anyone out there with a burning desire to speak on this subject? And so seeing that, I guess that answers our question. Thank you for the update.
Thank you.
And I'm going to go ahead and close the informational hearing on the signed task force and open an informational hearing. The first one we have is on climate-friendly transportation solutions. And Pam Peck with Metro, welcome.
It's not reasonable to say that we could run this.
Not on this one.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer.
Welcome.
And Chair Metzger and members of the committee. Thank you for inviting us to be here today. My name is Pam Peck, and I manage Metro's Regional Travel Options Program, and I'm joined today by Kelly Stoner with PacWest Communications, who's going to drive the technology for me here today, and then will also be available to answer questions at the end. Washington County Commission Chair Tom Bryan had hoped to be with us today to provide some opening remarks as part of my presentation, and he was not able to be here because of a previously scheduled engagement at the Railvolution Conference. So we would like to bring you his remarks via video to get things started. I'm sorry, we're having trouble with the sound. Did you plug this in? It was working earlier. We did test this. Let's go back one.
On.
We may have to go without this.
It's one of the best times I've ever heard Mr. Brown.
I wasn't going to make the comment.
Only kidding, Tom. Only kidding.
I'm hearing the feedback, but should we just go, Michael? Do you think it's going to come up? All right, well, we're going to go ahead and go, and we do have another soundbite later that hopefully we'll be able to give you, but Chair Bryan was basically giving an introduction that talked about the value of transportation demand management and reducing the number of cars that are on our roadways. But I did have a couple of slides that related to that, so I can talk about that a bit more. Transportation demand management is a key part of transportation system management that works to influence people's mode choice, as well as the route that they take to travel and the time of day at which they travel. It uses proven techniques to motivate travel behavior change, and it also attracts a lot of private investment and private partnerships. Today I'm going to share with you the Drive Less, Save More campaign, which is a key strategy we're using in the Portland region thanks to your funding to get people involved in these programs, as well as some other programs that are getting excellent results. And TDM strategies in our region are not just climate friendly, although they certainly have a huge impact on pollution and the environment. Motor vehicles are the largest source of air pollution in the Portland area, and our programs reduce each year more than 42,000 tons of greenhouse gases. But I think it's very important to point out that these programs are more than just climate friendly. They're good for our economy, and they're good for businesses in our region. Taking cars off the road at key peak periods helps to manage congestion, and it reduces costly delays. Our transit and rideshare sharing programs that I'm going to share with you today serve the needs of Oregon's workforce by expanding the geographic region from which employers can recruit employees, and other programs help them to retain employees with transportation benefits. Low-cost travel options like cycling and walking and using transit keep money in Oregonians' pockets by reducing the cost of operating vehicles, and they save millions a year in gas and other costs. Another key aspect is that these programs encourage people to use active transportation modes like biking and walking. Those programs, by increasing physical activity, help to prevent chronic diseases like diabetes. Those diseases have an incredible toll on our economy in terms of the costs of treating those diseases later on. So there's many ways in which these programs provide great benefits to our economy. Drive Less, Save More is a campaign that happened because of actions you took in 2003 when you directed ODOT to develop a marketing campaign that aimed to reduce single-person car trips as one part of the solution to addressing congestion. ODOT asked Metro to pilot the campaign in the Portland metropolitan region, and we hired PacWest Communications, Capelli Miles Spring, and More Information through a competitive process to develop and carry out the campaign, which they do under our management. The mission of the campaign is simple. It's to get people to increase their use of smart driving behaviors, like trip chaining or joining trips together, planning ahead and finding an efficient route, and to increase their use of travel options. We conducted background research to create a research-based campaign, and this is one of the things that Chair Brian talked about, is how research-based campaigns like this have proven their effectiveness in reaching audiences and getting people to change their behavior. We've had similar campaigns around recycling, around littering, around getting people to stop smoking. So we know these techniques work in terms of increasing awareness and changing behavior. The campaign is working to target non-work trips, those trips that make up about 67% of the trips we make. Those trips have the most potential for techniques like trip chaining or making a trip on another day, reducing a trip at a peak period, because they tend to be a bit more discretionary than, say, the trip to work. The other thing about trips like this is that they tend to be very short, so they have a lot of potential for being shifted to biking or walking. And the primary target audience for this campaign are the suburban residents of our region. Now, they, in some cases, have great travel options depending on where they live. In other cases, they may not even have a sidewalk outside their front door. But a key part of this campaign is that everybody can be part of the solution, because we can all adopt smart driving behaviors. And, in fact, if just each family in our region, each household in our region, reduced just 2 one-way trips each week, that could reduce 4 to 5% of the trips on the road. So the combined small actions of many of us have a powerful outcome. Our campaign mix has included what you typically see in a campaign like this. We're working to generate earned media coverage, which I'll talk about in a moment. We have memorable advertisements, which hopefully you've seen, which reach people through television and radio. A lot of our radio advertising is during radio traffic reports, so we're reaching people as they're thinking about preparing for a trip or while they're in a car experiencing congestion that they might like to avoid another day. We have talked with thousands of people at more than 250 community events, and 10,000 of those people have pledged to reduce their trips. We've been at farmers markets, fairs, and festivals, giving people one-on-one information in suburban communities about the travel options available to them. We've got a website that's a one-stop shop for lots of information, and I'm going to share with you some of the great activities that we've been able to involve sponsors in to leverage the campaign's resources. Our earned media has generated stories that are valued at more than $1.4 million. And earned media is really important because it gets information to people through a trusted source. They're more likely to trust a newspaper article or something they see on TV than something they see in an ad. It also provides real examples of people like them actually doing the desired behavior.
No, I'm sorry. I was just thinking about the current political campaign. I don't know if they believe it more or not, but that's...
I'll have to let you know that we actually aren't running any ads now. Not only are they extremely expensive right now, but since I think a lot of people are turning them off right now. So we are dark in terms of advertising now, but we're still pushing on all these other strategies that I just talked about. We use an independent analysis tool called PR Track to evaluate all these stories. So what would it cost us to purchase a story that would get the same exposure? And that's where that $1.4 million number comes from. Now, I had hoped to show you a clip from KGW-TV. They've been a major media sponsor of this campaign. And one of the activities we've had is a Drive Less, Save More family challenge. We've taken three busy suburban families families each year, challenge them to reduce their trips. They do a baseline week where they keep track of all of their activities, and then the next week is the challenge, and they use all of these different techniques to reduce their trips. We had an Oregon City family that won the challenge. That's the video we were going to show you. And over the course of a year, if they stuck with those habits, they would have saved $5,000 just in gasoline costs alone. Our media sponsors have really helped to extend the reach of the campaign by getting involved in activities like the Family Challenge. Our advertising, as I mentioned, has reached lots of folks. We've reached about 95% of the public over 40 times, I believe, at this point. And advertisements we run in the Portland market, as you probably know, also reach people across Oregon. So they are reaching most of the rest of the state except the very largest population. Eugene has its own market, and Medford, Ashland does. But Marion County, for example, is reached by all the television commercials. This is why the campaign website provides statewide information, because we know that people who see the ads see them from across the state. And the website provides lots of tips and tools for people. A driving cost calculator is one of our most popular features. And we launched this year a trip diary, which the governor's office used as part of their governor's commuter challenge to employees across the state. And that diary allows people to log their trips when they're involved in a campaign like that. They get immediate feedback because they can see the carbon that's been saved, the dollars they've saved, the other pollution benefits. They can sort of be in a friendly competition with their fellow employees, and then they can qualify for some great prizes. The Carefree Commuter Challenge in Washington County is another example of that. These challenges also attract lots of businesses that are interested in being involved in providing prizes for those efforts. And our sponsors have been just a really great part of this campaign. We have more than 65 partners. UPS is a great example. They provided travel makeovers for people, so they took those tips that the guys in Brown use, and they said, okay, how can you translate that to an everyday busy family? And they found that most people could save about 50 minutes of driving a week. The media loved the idea of travel makeovers, so we got lots of great stories out of that. AAA, OHSU, PCC have pushed our information and messages to thousands of members. Once again, this gets information to people from a trusted source, from their employer, from an organization that they care about. Intel has donated laptops and other prizes, and so have all of the sponsors involved have made some kind of a contribution to the campaign. So I want to take a quick look at the results that we are getting to date. This campaign really has created what we think of as an umbrella brand that can support and reinforce all the other programs that we use to encourage people to reduce trips, which I'll talk about some of those in a minute. But I want to talk to you about the research that we did for just a moment here. Bob Moore with More Information has conducted our research. The first poll was in September of 2005. That's where we did the background research to look at what did people think about this today and what are messages that would be effective. We launched the campaign in February of 2006 and then did another survey with an identical methodology 18 months later in June of 2007. Now, I don't have time to go through all those slides today, but the June 2007 survey results are in your packet so that you can take a look at those. I'm going to just share a few of the top-line results that I think are significant. One is that the number of people who feel it's very important to decrease or reduce their single-person car trips increased. So we went from 43% of people in the early poll saying it was important, very important, to 51% in the later poll. We also want to look at, in a campaign like this, recall. You know, we're putting all this energy out there. Do people remember it? So the survey wanted to know, did people remember the campaign, and did they take action because of what they saw, read, or heard? We found that 27% of people reported taking action, which is a good recall rate at 18 months in, and also considering the amount of advertising exposure at that time might have been 20 advertisements around at that time in the campaign. And obviously, we're reaching them through other efforts. But what's really significant is of those folks, 56% reported that they had taken action. Now, if you extrapolate that to the total population of our sample, that represents 15% of the total sample. So hypothetically, we did ask people what they did, and most of them said that they combine trips, reduce trips, or eliminated trips. So hypothetically, if those 179,000 people, which is what 15% of the total region would be, reduced just one shopping trip a month, so very conservatively, if they reduced one shopping trip a month, the impact was reducing 17.6 million miles over a year in vehicle miles of travel, $9 million in consumer cost savings, and significant reductions in greenhouse gas emissions and other pollution. So once again, it's those small actions having a powerful impact across the system. So another significant part of the poll is there's still a lot of potential for people to continue to reduce their trips, and I think this number is really remarkable. When we asked people, how difficult would it be for you to reduce one trip a week, 67% say it wouldn't be difficult, and remarkably 47% say it wouldn't be difficult to reduce one trip a day. So this shows us there's still potential to continue to get people to reduce those trips. So what's been the return on your investment in this campaign? You've invested a total of $3.4 million in this campaign, almost $3.5 million. We haven't spent all of that yet. We've got about a million to go before we wrap up this round. But the results so far have been the print and media stories that I mentioned to you, about $500,000 in donated advertising and close to $700,000 in support from sponsors. So the total value of the campaign is over $6 million at this point. We expect all of those numbers will grow in terms of the earned media, the donated advertising, and the sponsorship. So at the end of this fiscal year, at the end of June, you'll see that $6 million will be much higher. Now, I am just going to highlight just a couple of other key programs that are getting great results in our area that Drive Less, Save More helps to support. And these are some of the primary activities that the Regional Travel Options Program helps to support. And we do that through grants and partnerships with many organizations, both public and private, across the metro region. Employer programs are a really key part of this. I already talked about how these transportation programs really assist employers by helping them recruit from a wider geographic area. They also help them retain employees because a lot of these transportation benefits, like transit passes or having lockers and showers so you can bike to work, are highly valued by employees. The other reason companies are attracted to these programs is because they help them on the public health side in keeping their employees active. And a lot of cases, these programs are linked to wellness programs that employers use to help reduce their insurance costs. Our employer programs reduce more than 47 million vehicle miles a year. We have very good data on this because this comes from surveys that large employers have their employees take every other year. Those are mandated for employers that are over 100 employees through the DEQ's ECO program, but that gives us a data line I'll show you a little later, dating back to 1996, where we can see the effectiveness of these programs. So these employer programs are very extremely effective, and we get lots of participation. Another example of public-private partnerships, I've got a couple to share with you. One is this great new publication called Walk There. We're really proud of this, but this wouldn't have happened if Kaiser Permanente hadn't come forward with the concept of creating something like this and asking to partner with us and also to pay for the printing of this lovely book. 30,000 of these have been distributed to folks in the metro area to encourage them to walk more, to walk for their short trips, and this introduces people to local businesses. It makes them see that walking is pleasant and enjoyable, and it can actually get you where you need to go faster than you thought. And our early evaluation results from this, we're not finished with that, show very promising results in increasing walking. Transportation management associations are another great example. These are partnerships we have with chambers of commerce and local business associations. These are pretty much 50-50 partnerships. We put in about half the money, so there can be a staff person within that business association or chamber that focuses on programs like this and meeting the needs of the businesses in that area. In many cases, these are clusters of smaller businesses, so it allows these services to reach them. And I've listed some of the cities that have these programs and would be happy to talk with you more about them if you have questions about them. Individualized marketing is a strategy that reaches large residential areas that meet specific criteria, such as having destinations close to where people live and having travel options available for people to get to those destinations. The results from these projects have been so tremendous that Metro is going to invest $1 million in these programs over the next 4 years through our Regional Travel Options Grant Program. pilot projects in the Portland area, which have excellent before and after research, as well as control group samples to compare against, have shown that on average they can shift 5% of the trips people were making by car to other modes. And primarily what those are doing is shifting people to biking and walking, and then transit is kind of the next. The other thing we're seeing with these projects is it's reducing the length of people's trips, and this is primarily from people using businesses that are closer to home. And we anticipate these programs will reduce about 19,000 vehicle miles each year over the next 4 years through that investment of $1 million. Ride-sharing programs, I've touched on them. They assist thousands of people across our region and across the state. Carpool Match Northwest is a service that Metro runs. Actually, was started with a grant from the Climate Trust and support from the City of Portland. We have close to 12,000 commuters now using that program to help them find a ride match. Primarily, this is for commute trips, but we also have partnerships with all the ski areas on Mount Hood who use this tool to promote a one-time ride match, which can get people to skiing. We also work with large events who use this service to get people to get to their event through a carpool. Now, for those businesses, the ski areas and large events, they have parking management issues. They just don't have enough parking for the number of people that get there. So carpooling is a powerful tool for that that I haven't mentioned. We also have 30 van pools, and that's a partnership with a grant from ODOT, as well as funding from CTRAN in Clark County. And we have 30 that are now serving long-distance commutes in our region. We have folks coming in from Hood River, from Salem, and from many places with those van pools. There's incredible potential within this program to expand it to the entire state. Certainly a carpool matching system for the entire state makes a lot of sense, and I know ODOT's talking about that, and I know it's in many of the recommendations coming out of the governor's office. Of the 12,000 people using our system now, about 25% of them aren't trying to travel anywhere within the Portland metropolitan sort of travel shed. So they're not traveling from that kind of Hood River to Salem or from Clark County over. There's a lot of folks in Eastern Oregon and Southern Oregon that are using this tool. So that's what I wanted to say about that. So lots of potential to expand that. So just to wrap up, you know, how do we evaluate these programs? So I've mentioned some of the polling that we've done to evaluate Drive Less, Save More. We have surveys at employment sites that we've been doing for a number of years. For most of our programs, we're looking at a variety of things. We're looking at participation in those programs. We're looking at the satisfaction of people who participate in them. But the key thing we're looking for are those outcomes. Are we taking cars off the road? In order to make sure that our programs are getting results, we have worked with PSU. We've turned all our data over to them to do an independent evaluation of our program, and we do that every other year. So the last one was for 2005-2006, and they'll be doing another evaluation for us this coming spring. And what they found is that our programs are continuing to increase the share of non-SOV trips. This chart, which is very hard for you to see, but is in your packet, this is from our worksite data. So going back to 1996, worksites that have RTO programs in place are continuing to see an overall rise in the number of people using biking, walking, and transit to get to work. So just to wrap up, I want to thank you for your support for the Drive Less, Save More campaign. We are here committed to continue to raise awareness and move people to action to reinforce desired behaviors. We hope you'll take a serious look at expanding the Drive Less, Save More campaign to reach other targeted cities across Oregon and to consider expanding TDM programs and resources available to both the public and private sector to get more of these programs on the ground and working. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Tomei.
Oh, I love this book. Is it possible to get more of these?
I'd be happy to get you some more. Yeah.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you. I'm sorry the sound didn't work.
I'm sorry too.
Okay, I'm going to close that informational hearing and go ahead and open the next one, and that's Urban Trails as Transportation Facilities. So we have Metro Council President David Bragdon and Dave Yarden. Okay. I added an R. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Sure. by our members of the committee. Thank you for having us here today. Just yesterday, the governor was talking about the need to act on climate change. That's one of the objectives that's served by what we're going to be talking about today. But there are certainly multiple objectives that are served and that are shaping the environment about transportation planning and funding today.
Identify yourself.
Metro Council President David Bragdon, and with me is Mr. Dave Yeadon, who will also speak for himself. As we know, there are a lot of factors that are changing paradigms in terms of how we look at transportation, transportation planning and funding right now. Climate change, the change in fuel prices, changes in fuel availability and where it comes from relative to our national security, the recognition that traffic is growing much faster than our ability to build our way out of congestion, which we now is impossible. Also the recognition that there have been forms of transportation that are actually destructive to community, and there are other forms of transportation that build community. So all these are adding up to a lot of new realities. The conventional wisdom of the past has to be questioned. And we think that part of a multifaceted solution in terms of urban transportation, in terms of reducing dependence on fossil fuels and in terms of addressing global warming is to enhance the urban trails network. We have some experience with that already. The Springwater Trail, which is in Representative Tomei's, or portions of it are certainly in Representative Tomei's district, as we have improved that using funding from a Parks Fund measure as well as transportation funds. That is a trail connecting downtown Portland with Milwaukee and then further out to Gresham. Before those improvements were made in terms of bridges being added, there were about 650 people a day using that. There are now more than 2,500 people a day using it. That's just on bicycles, say nothing of the people who are out for a walk, either to get from place to place or just for their own exercise. So despite the relatively small amount of funding that has been spent on trails to this point, which should be about 0.4% of the transportation funds in our region being spent on urban trails, we really are seeing results that are far beyond what would be expected. We have a plan for a network in our region. If it were built out, it would connect about 1.1 million people, 268 schools, about 675,000 jobs. And if we can achieve the type of usership that we've had just with the limited progress that we've made, it's easy to imagine we can do so much more with increased investment in that. We look to take a look at where we could go next with the system. We impaneled a Blue Ribbon Committee about 6 months ago, which I deliberately assembled people who were not all parks and trails advocates, but came from different walks of life. Tourism industry is represented, healthcare industry being represented, as well as business leaders. Senator Monroe is also on that committee. You know, obviously he's been very conversant with the state transportation system, and he's been a big help on that as well. And Dave Yeadon has been chairing that committee, so with your permission, I'd like to turn that over so that he could give their report.
Thank you, David. I am David Yeadon, chair of the Metro Blue Ribbon Committee for Trails. As David indicated, it's a diverse and pretty hard-headed group in a lot of ways. What I want to do today is take you through a fairly simple but surprising story about the journey that the committee itself went through. As we began, we understood our task to be to look at the existing proposals for building out the kind of multi-use separated trails around the whole region. I think some of you may know Forest Grove has wonderful plans for completing its trail system, and a lot of communities think these are truly ornaments central to the livability of their community. So our task was to look about could we accelerate the 100 years that it was going to take to build out this set of important urban infrastructure. Along the way, we conducted so far 5 meetings, have one more to go. We looked closely at lessons from Europe and elsewhere, and we passed some important milestones. I think the first is that we really did grow in appreciation for the unique type of urban infrastructure investment that these trails represent. They represent a way to connect up within communities and connect communities and to create a range of values and benefits that's really unparalleled as you think about urban infrastructure, whether it's transportation, access within communities, and we're talking about things like safe routes for kids to get to school, the health benefits that come, the recreational stuff, all these things that people just instinctively value about trails. We came to appreciate the breadth and depth of value that these things really do represent for communities. What was more surprising is that the more we looked, the more we came to appreciate that these trails represent a potential as serious transportation investments that had escaped us as we convened. We just had not had the experience here of seeing them work that way, but we as a committee have come to conclude that these in fact offer a ripe, timely, and generally good and relatively cheap, let me stress relatively cheap, form of transportation investment. We've come to this conclusion for a couple of reasons. First of all, we know that there are approximately 60% of the population out there who are willing to walk and use bikes for short, reasonable trips as long as they feel safe. And frankly, they don't feel safe simply using bike lanes or being on roads that are otherwise unmarked. So there's a vast potential untapped audience out there, and it includes kids. We know from a lot of experience that if kids get used to riding bikes, they'll get back on their bikes and go to school, and that's not happening now. As you begin to think about the potential payoff in terms of the health of our kids and everything else, it's very significant. And one of the things that they teach you and you learn from Europe is if kids grow up on bikes, they'll use bikes, period. So that's in part, I think, why we have a doctor from Kaiser, who is in the pediatrics section, and the CEO of Providence on our committee. They believe this can be very significant on the health side. So that's caught our attention. So we think there's a way to tap into that much larger audience out there if we build the right kind of facilities and do it correctly. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that, but I do want to emphasize that we understand that you got to do these things right. They have to be fast, convenient, efficient. They have to provide a good experience for people in the sense that they really do become an attractive competitor with the car. That can happen. We've seen it happen. But it's not just a matter of, well, you build anything and it'll work. So these things can work. That is a very important message that I want to deliver. They're not toys. They're not frills or something. We think there's real potential out here. Now, the second thing is that we can't think of any other transportation investment that fits the moment we are at and the choices we need to make. I want to, if you'll indulge me, I just want to read from Robert Fuentes, who's the sort of transportation guru at the Brookings Institution. He wrote a book called A Bridge to Somewhere, Rethinking American Transportation for the 21st Century. Here's a relatively brief quote. We must recognize that we are on the cusp of a new wave of transportation policy. The infrastructure challenge of President Eisenhower's 1950s was to build out our nation and connect within. For Senator Moynihan and his colleagues in the 1980s and 90s, it was to modernize the program and better connect roads, transit, rail, air, and other modes. Today, the challenge is to take transportation out of its box in order to ensure the health, vitality, and sustainability of our metropolitan areas. That's the end of the quote.
You know, if you're not a policy wonk, but an average guy like me, it's no secret. Congestion, climate change, oil prices, peak oil. We read about your struggles to find enough money to just maintain the road network we've now got in place. We all understand the consequences of trying to build communities by building more roads through them, which is why we turned in the Mount Hood Freeway and embarked on the path we did. So, again, we come back to that this set of investments, if we begin to do them right, don't overdo it at the beginning, but learn as we go, can, like light rail, begin to make a very significant difference over time. So we thought a little bit about how we actually want to develop this program, the strategy, but rather than go through that now, I'd just like to leave you with an invitation to take the same journey we have as a committee, to recognize these as a serious transportation option and potential, and help us get started down that path. And with that, I think we'd be happy to take questions.
Well, and also to acknowledge that actually Representative Reed did accept an earlier invitation to literally go on a journey this July. We appreciate his time. He spent the day looking at a lot of the trail possibilities in his district and how those connect with some of the major employers, including his employer, and appreciated having you there.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Verger, sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did you talk about funding?
Did you notice that I didn't? we are just at the point, Senator Verger. I'm sorry, Chair Beyer, Senator Verger. I'll remember my etiquette here in a moment. We are just at the point where we are coming to a conclusion with our work. What we are expecting we will end up pushing and recommending is, first of all, some recognition in policy, however, that these can be serious transportation investments. Secondly, an increase at the state level in funding for non-motorized transportation, probably competitive or offerings available throughout the state for a variety of non-motorized transportation, simply to continue to increase that pool of flexible funds. We are also at the early stages of looking at the possibility of focusing on several demonstration projects that would make a big difference. And we have in mind some that would, for example, be in the suburbs and work to make more efficient and effective use of the connections with the transit system. Some of you may have seen the story in the Oregonian the other day about TriMet's difficulty in providing enough park and ride spaces. We think there's a potential for some of these trails maybe to offer connections to transit that we haven't yet explored that we really would like to look at. Finally, we are just in, again, very early stages of beginning talks with other communities around the state about their interest, and we think there really is some. Eugene Springfield area, Ashland, other areas, and finally, the tourist folks, people in tourism business have a real interest in seeing whether there's finally a way to connect some things up and make this all work. Beyond that, we have not delved into the funding.
Okay. Thank you.
And I could add, Chair. Chair Beyer, Senator Verger, on the funding, the practice to date has been opportunistic in terms of tapping into a variety of funds. In addition to what Mr. Yaden said, there's been parks programs that we're able to tap into in some instances. In other instances, there are other public rights of way, another in Representative Tomei's district called the Trolley Trail, which connects Milwaukee to Gladstone. Sewer work was being done underneath that right of way, so coincident with the sewer replacement taking place, when the excavation was finished, the agency provided a trail on top. So there's one needs to be creative in finding different pots of funds for these.
May I respond?
Yes.
I've always just been a little perplexed as to why we have not licensed bicycles. We have created the problem of funding for bicycle lanes,
And now, on the Oregon coast where I serve, we have a hazardous condition with so many people riding bicycles on Highway 101. Some places where it's so hazardous that we've had some fatalities. So, but I do believe that if we're going to continue to make things accessible to bicyclists, which I think is very, very good. I've ridden a bike much of my life, but I think that they need to pay some fair share of the expense, and I hope that you'll look at that.
Okay. Chair Beyer, Senator Berger, I'm happy to take that message back to the committee, and I bet there'll be some more interest in at least exploring that. Thank you.
I just quickly make a comment on that topic. Randy Tucker from Medville. Chair Beyer, as you know, I've been attending most of the meetings of the Transportation Vision Committee that the governor put together, and I don't presume to speak for the BTA, but I will relay, at least, I think the Bicycle Transportation Alliance's openness to that very concept. I don't think the bicycle community, or at least the official, whatever you want to call it, you know, the nonprofit that works on behalf of the bicycle community, necessarily objects to that. I think there are a lot of questions as to setting up a system and what does it cost, and just, you know, does it cost more than you get from it, and that sort of thing. But in concept, the bicycle community, I think, is actually on board with that. You know, they're interested in investing in the system just like everybody else.
Thank you. And I know that Representative Buckley has...
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate Senator Bridger's remarks. I think that's a good avenue to go down to look for things. I want to just express our appreciation, gentlemen, for this idea and bringing forward, and it's great. Also, compliment Metro on the Drive Less, Save More campaign. And let the committee know, and I think Metro President Bragdon already is aware of our Bear Creek pathway we have in Jackson County, which we're expanding to go from Ashland all the way to Grants Pass, working with ODOT and States Parks. So it will be the Bear Creek then Rogue River pathway, which will be a bicycle path, pedestrian path that will run all of the Rogue Valley for linking up all of our communities. So we're doing it down south as well, folks. Just wanted to know.
Thank you. No other questions? I do also want to comment on the fee for bicycles, and I know that there are a number of people who feel that it's really only fair that they start picking up a portion of the cost. I think the challenge, again, has been how do you develop a system that's not going to cost more to run than you're going to be able to raise. And I think that there's a lot of interest. I think that there's a lot of people that seem to think that if we're looking at additional revenue for transportation, that we really should be including the bicycle population in that too. So I certainly am not ruling anything out. I just think it's going to be a challenge to come up with the funding mechanism to do it. And with that, I don't see any other questions, so thank you. I really appreciate it. I apologize for misstating your name. And unless there's any other business from the group, I'm going to go ahead. Yes.
Madam Chair, committee members, our next meeting, we'll be putting out an agenda soon, will be Monday, November 10th, 10 o'clock is our start time. The governor is planning to attend that meeting and to unveil his transportation funding package for the 2009 session. We'll also have an update from TriMet on their security update that's required now. And I believe we're going to hear on the senior and disabled transportation report that DHS and ODOT have prepared as well.
What time is that?
10 o'clock.
And how long do we anticipate that will be?
We'll definitely be done by 2, I would say. A lot of it will depend on how much discussion there is on the transportation plans. So. Oh, yeah. I'm very certain we'll be done by 2.
I can adjourn the house.
Yes. Thank you, Nancy.
We are adjourned.
Your audience, you're there.
Senator Berger, do you
want to adjourn us?
It's no other business to come before this party. I call the meeting again.